And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Monday, September 23rd, 2024. A Sudanese politician says the paramilitary rapid support forces lack legitimacy. And some lawyers say the extension of the transitional period in South Sudan is unconstitutional. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
While they are mandated by the Constitution to conduct the election in the country and not to extend...
A group of South Sudanese lawyers have filed a lawsuit with the country's Supreme Court over government's decision to extend the transitional period by 2 years, calling the move unconstitutional. One activist says the move is a waste of time since the presidency and regional bodies have accepted, and some regional bodies have accepted the extension. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Speaking to reporters after presenting their petition to Supreme Court Chief Justice Chanrich Madut, lawyer Deng John Deng says the group of five constitutional lawyers will follow up with the petition this week.
The petition is again the government of the Republic of South Sudan with all his institutions, presidency, the legislature and the council of ministers, all these institutions, we petition them before the court because they extend the transitional government, and while they are mandated by the constitution to conduct the election in the country and not to extend the government for more than two times. This is why we are here. We petition the government and we requested the court to entertain our petition and then to order the government to declare this unconstitutional extension of the transitional period.
Peter Maler is a youth activist who has been closely following the 2018 peace agreement. He says several parties were involved in the extension and the lawyer's petition will die.
I believe that the current issues are happening, and of course we believe, through my experience, I know that the process of the extension has been predetermined. One is that there has been largely a lack of political will. We have also seen interference from the region, because you've seen how the extension was agreed upon by a number of institutions in the region to be pushed ahead, especially the Algemec.
But Deng says they'll have hope in the court and they'll unveil their plan if they fail to get justice.
The Supreme Court is a custodian of the national constitution and the constitution of the state. If there is any infringement or any violation to the provision of the constitution, the Supreme Court will be there to protect the right of the people of the Republic of South Sudan. We have confidence in our court. This is why we are here. We submit our petition before the Honorable Chief Justice, and we are trusting him that he will entertain our petition. And then after that, if the constitutional petition was entertained and determined by the court, we will decide what will happen next.
Peter says the move by the lawyers is a genuine approach to test the justice system.
I strongly believe and know that whatever much the lawyers could do, it is not going to revive the process, but it is important into helping the people of South Sudan to start demanding and start being able to be prepared to challenge such situation that are forced on them.
On Friday, the Transitional National Legislative Assembly rapidly passed a measure to extend the transitional period. Over the weekend, the president signed and amended the 2011 transitional period by 2 years. Earlier this month, the presidency extended the transitional period but received criticism from politicians, civil society and international donors, especially the Troika nations. Britain, Norway, and the United States called it a failure of the government to implement the peace agreement. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Some residents in South Sudan's Bor County who farmed this year say they have had a good harvest of sorghum compared to last year. One resident says his harvest could support his family for some time to come. Manyang David Mayer has more for VOA from Juba.
56-year-old Granquir says the dire humanitarian and economic situation in the country prompted him to cultivate his land in order to support his family.
Farming is the only way for our survival. Dollar is too high and life is so bad, and I decided to do farming in order to feed my children. I have 6 children, and this does not need me to be relaxed. Farming is what our grandparents used to depend on.
Akur Kwalding, another resident of Bor Town, says she has depended on food provided by humanitarian organizations in displacement camps in Minkaman. She says recently she decided to grow her own food for her family after rations were suspended.
I have cultivated sorghum here to avoid depending on UN food in Nyamazi and Gwalior, and that is why I have decided to take the hoe and produce what to eat. When I have some excess, I will sell some to pay for my child's school fees. I may get 10 bucks from here.
In 2022, the World Food Programme suspended food assistance to 1.7 million people in South Sudan following a shortage of funding. Yuot Quirbol, a member of the South Sudan's People's Defense Forces, says repeated salary delays have forced him to look for alternative means of survival.
I am working for the government and the salary is not regular and it is also not enough due to inflation. That is why I thought of cultivation. It is helping a lot. Now I will only lack things like oil, but not food anymore.
In May, South Sudan's Ministry of Trade launched a subsidized food center that distributes supplies to Juba stores, which are sold at affordable prices as a way to counter high market food prices. The ministry says it is working with local farmers to produce more food for local markets to curb dependency on food imports from neighboring countries. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
President Joe Biden makes his final presidential address before the United Nations General Assembly this week, but hanging over his head as he takes to the Green Marble podium for the last time, and as he meets separately with other leaders in New York, conflict in the Middle East and how his actions have shaped it is going to dominate discussions. My colleague Yehia Swihib spoke to our UN correspondent Margaret Bashar on the latest in New York.
Well, I think really the wars in Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan are going to dominate leaders' speeches this week, side meetings, bilaterals between leaders. These are the three biggest pressing issues. They affect not just the three countries and regions where they're happening, but they have global implications. So these are definitely high on the agenda. And then we also have going on, started on Sunday and it's concluding today, the Summit for the Future. And this is Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General's signature event this year. The idea is to make a blueprint for global institutional reform. He said, we can't create a future fit for our grandchildren with systems built for our grandparents, since most multilateral institutions grew out of World War II, which is, nearly a century ago now. So this has been also a major side event here at the UN this week. A lot of world leaders here for that.
And Margaret, what are the big issues for African nations?
Well, I think coming out of this Summit of the Future that we're in right now, they adopted what's called a Pact for the Future by consensus on Sunday. It was a little bit down to the wire. There were some objections from the Russians. They had been raising some objections to language in the document throughout the negotiations in the last week or so. These are months-long negotiations that wrapped up. But I think one of the big things in the document is about Security Council reform. The UN Security Council has 15 members, and for decades, really, countries in the global south have been pressing for the council to expand, saying that they're not well represented. And this Pact for the Future commits to expanding the Security Council to make it more reflective of today's world. And it says to redress the historical injustice against Africa, which has no permanent seat. And we heard from the U.S. ambassador last week that the United States, the Biden administration, supports two permanent seats for Africa on the council. However, one of the caveats is that they don't support anybody who gets a permanent seat now, getting a veto. So the veto would still remain with the five traditional powers. But this is still the biggest step toward enlarging the Security Council since 1963. And I think it may get some traction now after, honestly, decades of people just talking about it. We may actually start to see something, and that would be big for Africa. And the other big thing, I think, is reform of the international financial institutions that's mentioned in this pact, debt refinancing. You know, so many countries in Africa are drowning in debt, especially after the COVID pandemic. So that would be a huge step for Africa. Political front, the war in Sudan.
Definitely the war on Sudan. Who are the participants in the Summit of the Future today?
Right. So today we're going to be wrapping up the Summit of the Future, and we're going to hear from the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. He's arrived in New York. He'll be speaking later this afternoon. The president of Ukraine will also be speaking at the summit today. But we also have a lot of African leaders, presidents of Botswana, Senegal, Mauritania, Libya, Mauritius. We have a lot of African leaders also speaking today. This morning, we're going to hear from Zimbabwe's president. So we have a lot of action.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashar talking to my colleague Yehes Wihub. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. Coming up, a Sudanese politician says RSF should not be taken seriously. Find out why after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. UN spokesperson Stephen Dujarric says UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on RSF leader General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo to halt his attack on Sudan's El Fashir. UN Secretary General says he is gravely alarmed by reports of full-scale assault on the town by the Rapid Support Forces. Hussein Singari is the Foreign Affairs Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Sudan. He tells my colleague James Batty that RSF is, quote, a terrorist organization and should not be treated the same as the Sudan military.
It is very good what they've been thinking or thought about Sudan and about the army. But the only one concern is that they always, when they talk about the rapid force and the Sudanese army, they make them as an equal. And that is wrong, because the Sudanese army is the government official army. Okay, it is have a diversity of people from east, west, and, you know, all different area, north. But this rapid force is just from the west. There are one tribe or maybe two tribes plus the scattered Arabs from rest of Africa. They think that they are superior. They think that they have to take the Sudan over and it's be their country. Those tribes in scattered in Africa, in Sudan they call them Janjaweed. In other places they just call them, some of them like Boko Haram and all those other tribes. Actually, they have a bad influence in anywhere they go. Even in Sudan, when they start this war, they go to the people's houses, they take it from them, they take their wives, you know, they rape them, they take them as a slavery. Right now, they sell them in Chad, in different other countries, as, you know, the sex slaves, and that's what they do.
Whatever the rapid support forces are, they are part of the conflict, and in order to find solution to the conflict, you have to get them involved.
Okay, if you are want to make a solution with Boko Haram, you're going to sit with them and ask them, you know, to be part of the settlement and to join and to be part of the government. The rapid force is the same like Boko Haram. It's the same like Al-Qaeda. It's a terrorist organization. There is no way to sit with them. And those people, you know, they can't agree to anything. If they will say from their mouth, okay, we agree to that. But they never do that. And the other thing, there is no control. Even the leader, Hemeti, he cannot control them. Because those guys are just being hired for money, for gold, for anything that to steal it, you know. In Khartoum, you know what they did? All the houses, they took the furniture, everything. Everything from the whole city, nothing left in the houses there. They put it in trucks and they ship it to different African countries and they sell it there.
Suppose the Secretary General of the United Nations call on you to say, help the United Nations. How would you like for us to resolve this conflict in Sudan? What would you do?
What I'm saying is we have to fight them the same thing like what we did with Boko Haram, what we did with Al-Qaeda, what we did with any terrorist organization. They have to consider them as a terrorist organization.
That's Hussein Sangray, Foreign Affairs Secretary of the People's Democratic Party of Sudan. He spoke to my colleague James Batty. In the past 6 years, award-winning Nigerian investigative journalist Philip Obach has uncovered human rights abuses by Russian paramilitary forces in West and Central Africa, despite facing personal danger, including being held hostage and tortured by Central African Republic rebels and soldiers. Obagi has investigated massacres, rape, and oppression allegedly committed by mercenaries from the Wagner Group and its successor, the African Cause. He is currently in the United States to testify at a hearing by the U.S. Commission on Inquiry and Cooperation in Europe on Russia's imperial identity. Obagi tells VOA's Jackson Vunganyi that he was initially investigating the death of three Russian journalists in the Central African Republic.
I went close to the Central African Republic, went to Cameroon, tried to get into the country. It was difficult, but I still was able to ask questions, making phone calls, and I kind of had people tell me a little bit about where this journalist had gone to and exactly what the mission was exactly. So something struck me. I realized that they were not just going to confirm whether or not the Wagner Group was active in the country. They were going to look into every single operation that Wagner was doing in the country. Mm. And I wanted to continue from where they stopped. So that's why I began to focus.
That's how you started. Yeah, that's how I started following to focus. The tracks, yeah, exactly. Of these journalists and kind of finishing up the work.
Yes, what they couldn't complete, I wanted to finish.
So let's talk about these paramilitary groups, the Wagner Group and, subsequent group called the Africa Corps. What has been their role in shaping the political and military landscape of the CAR and now in Mali, as we know?
Well, they do a lot in the Central African Republic, much more than they do anywhere else in Africa. And before they came to the Central African Republic in 2017, much of the country was in the hands of rebels and militia groups that were seeking to overthrow government. So what Wagner has done that may be beneficial to the government is the fact that they've been able to keep Bangui, the capital, safe from these rebels and militia men. So they have they've been able to put themselves in very critical positions in government. The national security advisor to the president of the Central African Republic is a Russian. The communications advisor is a Russian. So you have Russian paramilitaries from the Wagner Group, everywhere in the country, manning some very important facilities, including gold and diamond mines. And you have Russian instructors, so-called Russian instructors, training the military in the Central African Republic. So pretty much what they do is, provide security for government and train local forces, but also, they are the police themselves in many places.
Mm.
Yeah.
And they were invited by the government?
Of course.
Okay. So what are some of the things that you've uncovered in, the atrocities they have committed over the years?
Yeah,
some of the...
quite a lot. Their interest is in the gold and diamond resources in the country. And these resources are, scattered around the country, particularly in the northwest and in the northeast. And what the Russians want to do is to completely control these resources. The problem they face is that before they came into the country, these mines were under the control of the rebels and in some places, Christian militias. So to take control of these mines, they've had to fight. And they go into communities, open fire at the local people, they torture artisanal miners, women, scales.
So are they trying to scare away the people from these communities around the mine so they can take control of it? So they,
that's correct. Yeah. And they make no distinction between the rebels and the local people. Yes. So they believe that even the locals, you know, work closely with the rebels. So it's a way of scaring people away, as you put it, and also a way of, you know, creating fear. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's what basically has been happening.
That's Philip Obagi, an award-winning Nigerian investigative journalist. He spoke to VOA's Jackson Vunganyi. The United Nations Children's Fund says more deaths are being recorded in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi following the outbreak of mpox. Dr. Douglas Noble is UNICEF's Associate Director for Health for Emergency Preparedness. He tells VOA's Chinedu Ofo that more work needs to be done to break community transmission and save lives.
The situation is not yet under control, and now is really the time to act, to make the investments, to support the governments, particularly of Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi, but also other countries in the region as well, to respond to the outbreak, but also to prepare. The virus is behaving differently in different contexts, and there are different variants of the virus. So there's still a lot that we are learning. For example, in Burundi, there hasn't been any deaths, whereas here in DRC, there's been quite a considerable number of deaths, around 700 or 800 so far. There are other underlying issues. For example, there are issues related to children who are malnourished. There are issues related to undiagnosed HIV/AIDS. There are underlying issues around water and sanitation issues, for example. And so we're still trying to understand the contextual factors as to what leads this to being more severe in some children and then in other countries being less severe.
A few months ago, there was this concern about mpox vaccine coming into that area. A few weeks ago, there were reports that some got in. Do you have enough mpox vaccine? What is the current situation in terms of availability?
There's always a lot of interests in vaccines. I think the first thing I'd want to say is that vaccines are not a silver bullet for responding to this outbreak. This is very much an outbreak which needs a whole range of interventions to control it. Risk communication and community engagement is critically important so that people are aware of the virus, what it can do, how they can protect themselves, if they get it, how to get help. We need to improve infection prevention and control in communities, in schools and public spaces. And we need to make sure that people are well nourished and are immunocompetent so that if they get the disease, their bodies are actually able to handle it. Those things are critically important to breaking community transmission in this outbreak.
What kind of pressures are you and your staff facing in dealing with this problem?
There's a number of different pressures that the staff face. I mean, one is the operating context. I was in a school yesterday in Equateur province in the northwest of Democratic Republic of Congo, and there was no water in the school. Well, that's a real challenge if you look at infection prevention control procedures, for example.
That's Dr. Douglas Noble, UNICEF's Associate Director for Emergency Preparedness and Response. He spoke to VOA's Chinedu Ofo. In Goma, a town in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a woman-led recycling company is tackling plastic pollution and creating jobs for some of the country's millions of internal displaced people. Reporter Zanim Neti Zaidi takes us inside the entrepreneur's business.
Irene Maroy is a manager at the Resilience for Development Group, or RDG, a women-owned business that turns plastic waste into eco-friendly paving stones. Based in Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the company provides jobs for people displaced by years of war. Maroy says her focus is on young internally displaced people, hoping to prevent them from joining armed groups.
When I saw so many young people turning to armed groups because they had no jobs, I knew I had a duty to help, and when war forced our fellow citizens to flee to the city, I decided to support some of the displaced by buying the plastic waste they collect. Thanks to this, many, especially women, are now able to provide for their families.
As of April 2024, the DRC had 6.8 million internally displaced people, according to the United Nations. Boniface Kaina, a father of seven, is one of them. He says he's grateful for the job with RDG.
By the grace of God, I met Irene. She taught me how to turn plastic waste into eco-friendly paving stones. I'm grateful because on the 15th and 30th of each month, I get paid before the World Food Program assists us in the camp. That money helps me and my family survive.
The company also aims to make a dent in plastic waste. For almost 3 years, the paving stones produced by the company have helped clean up the city of Goma and have been laid in private plots as well, says customer Gloire Muhindo.
I chose to buy these paving stones mainly because they are made locally, which really motivated me. They are made from plastic waste, like bags and bottles, that litter our city. Supporting this initiative not only promotes recycling, but also helps keep our city clean.
That's all we prepared for you this Monday, September 23rd, 2024. We apologize for some of the technical glitches during this broadcast. Some things are just beyond our control when they happen. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Shen Shen.
Work for justice and for the heads of the states.
I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Chang, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over 3 months have passed since Houthi militants rounded up scores of United Nations staff, all of whom were working to bring life-saving assistance to the Yemeni people at the time of their detention. Speaking to the UN Security Council, Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs, called for the immediate and unconditional release of all detainees, including 11 U.S. diplomatic staff members held since 2021.
The Houthis continue to not only mistreat these detainees, but also seek to exploit them through the release of so-called confession videos. This shameless propaganda is appalling and should be universally condemned. Houthi intimidation tactics have also increasingly focused on the remaining Yemeni staff of UN agencies and non-governmental organizations. Humanitarian workers in the Houthi-controlled parts of Yemen are increasingly worried about their safety. There is absolutely no justification for the threatening and intimidation of UN workers and others carrying out their lawful humanitarian work.
The Houthis' continued attacks against ships in the Red Sea and surrounding waterways also continue to threaten regional peace and security, as well as international navigational freedoms, warned Ambassador Wood.
These continued unjustified actions have already resulted in the tragic deaths of innocent mariners and continue to threaten the lives of member state citizens and interests of the international community. Every time the Houthis launch an attack, they not only threaten the lives of mariners from many nations, but also risk creating an environmental catastrophe from damage to oil tankers and other ships carrying hazardous materials.
The Houthis have made clear they care only about themselves, said Ambassador Wood. They are willing to destroy the fishing industry and regional ecosystems that Yemen and other communities in the region rely on for their livelihoods, just as they have undermined the delivery of vital humanitarian aid to the region. Ambassador Wood urged council members to make clear to the Houthis' backers in Tehran that they hold Iran responsible for arming and enabling the Houthis to carry out attacks. Recent flooding in Yemen has made support and technical assistance from the United States and other international partners more crucial than ever. This is not the time for political posturing and disunity, warned Ambassador Wood. It is time for the Council to work together to address the political, security, and humanitarian challenges that plague Yemenis. That was an